Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion titled An Elegant Hope, Despair as a Virtue After Nietzsche. Our speaker is Ryan Coyne, Assistant Professor of the Philosophy of Religions and Theology at University of Chicago Divinity School. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel.
Professor Coyne, Ryan Coyne, studies the relationship between modern European philosophy and the history of Christian thought. His research so far has focused on phenomenology, hermeneutics, and deconstruction. His first book, which has won an important prize in Europe, is Heidegger's Confessions, The Remains of St. Augustine in Being and Time and Beyond. This examines the shifting roles assigned to religion and to Augustine of Hippo, more specifically in Martin Heidegger's early, middle, and later work. He's currently completing a second book, tentatively entitled A Spectacle for the Gods, Nietzsche and the Question of Faith. In it, he analyzes Nietzsche's struggle to redefine faith after the death of God, arguing that this struggle sheds new light on recent debates in continental philosophy of religion. His teaching generally focuses on the theme of subjectivity, temporality, and the nature of religious experience in ancient and contemporary sources. And it's really out of that discussion and out of that teaching that tonight's lecture arose. The topic tonight on which he will lecture is Radical Hope, Despair, and Time, Three Responses to Nietzsche. So please join me in welcoming one of the bright, promising young scholars of the philosophy of religion from the University of Chicago, Professor Ryan Coyne.
Thank you so much. Let me begin by extending a personal thank you to Professor David Eckel for the invitation to come here today and to all the members of the Institute for the Philosophy of Religion at Boston University, and also to all of you for coming today. Radical Hope is Jonathan Lear's haunting portrait of Plenty Coup, the last great chief of the American Crow tribe, who came of age during the 1840s when the Crow, devastated by disease and tribal warfare and the westward expansion of European peoples, faced extermination, the extermination of their way of life. The record of this extermination is haunting in its own right. Lear compounds the effect by arguing that in bearing witness to a universal human vulnerability, to the catastrophic breakdown of culture, Plenty Coup can actually serve as an ethical ideal. On Lear's telling, Plenty Coup counsels the Crow that instead of fighting to preserve their way of life, at least as they understood it up until the latter half of the 19th century, the Crow had to be willing to renounce everything they held dear, everything that conferred sense and meaning upon their lives. Only by first embracing the devastation of their culture could the Crow then glimpse a future beyond catastrophe and, quote, hope for the emergence of a Crow subjectivity that did not yet exist, end quote. The courage to embrace and transcend catastrophe is what Lear calls radical hope. Here I quote, radical hope anticipates a good for which those who have the hope as yet lack the appropriate concepts with which to understand it, end quote. Lear offers this definition at the outset of the book's third section, entitled The Critique of Abysmal Reasoning. This critique is one of the most challenging and provocative sections of Radical Hope, drawing an analogy between the crises faced by indigenous peoples of the Americas in the late 19th century and the existential threats humanity faces in the early 21st century. The Critique of Abysmal Reasoning seeks to establish what we might legitimately hope at a time when the sense and purpose and meaning that has been bequeathed to us by our culture has collapsed. Taking his cue from Aristotle and Freud, Lear argues that Plenty Coup's fidelity to a prophetic dream he had in his youth counts as a courageous response to the breakdown of the Crow way of life, that it furnished the Crow with unparalleled resources for negotiating the widespread devastation of indigenous cultures, and that in retrospect, this hope, the hope it inspired in Pleniku, vindicated him personally and historically. Now, while Lear is primarily concerned with justifying radical hope as a virtue, there's a paradox, I believe, hidden in this project that I take to be particularly instructive. The paradox stems from pairing together radical hope and abysmal reasoning. The term radical signifies that which goes to the root of things, that which extends to the deepest depths, from radix in Latin. The term abysmal comes from the Latin abyssimum, or abyss. It designates a groundless or bottomless depth, or alternatively a sequence without a limit. There is at least a minimal conflict involved in justifying the radical nature of hope by appealing to abysmal reasoning. On the one hand, it's impossible to speak of rootedness when it comes to the abyss. Since the abyss is by definition groundless, it necessarily relativizes the difference between what is and is not radical. On the other hand, the truly radical is worthy of its name only if the distance it traverses is infinite. Hence the paradox, or the antinomy, involved in Lear's critique of hope. To say that radical hope comes into view against the background of an abysmal reasoning is already to suggest that hope, like reasoning itself, is abysmal. So this is my central hypothesis. In order to be radical, hope must also be abysmal. By this I mean not only that radical hope is ultimately groundless and thus scandalous, such that one can never actually succeed in justifying it, but also that in its actual form, as opposed to its content, radical hope is destined to converge with its opposite, that namely, despair. Pleniku, for instance, advocates the death of his way of life, admitting there's no hope for it. And only on this basis can he hope against hope for its resurrection. So not unlike theological hope, radical hope is constituted essentially by this moment of self-contestation. Paul, in his letter to the Romans, describes Abraham as hoping against hope, par elpida et elpidi, in the Greek, that he would become the father of many nations, which implies that hope is genuine only to the degree that it's internally divided. So to hope against hope is inevitably to keep hoping when there is nothing left to hope for, when all bets are off. Miguel de Unamuno writes in The Tragic Sense of Life that, quote, "It is despair and despair alone which engenders heroic hope, absurd hope, mad hope. Spero quia absurdum is what we should say, rather than credo quia absurdum," end quote. But if genuine hope is essentially governed by this absurd logic, or the logic of the absurd, if it's no less abysmal than it is radical, then the critique of hope can never be assured that genuine hope is virtuous. Instead, it must consider the various ways in which hope, turning against itself, converges with despair. This is the directive that I think emerges from the privileged example of Pleniku. Lear's critique of abysmal reasoning takes up the challenge of Immanuel Kant, who argues that philosophy is obliged to answer the question, what may I hope? Now, we can promote, I believe, the aims of this critique of abysmal reasoning by considering the legacy of Friedrich Nietzsche in the European tradition. There's nothing arbitrary at all about this choice. It is motivated by the assumption that in tying the question of hope to nihilism, Nietzsche is one of the figures who sets the terms in which the remnants of theological hope circulate in 20th century philosophical texts. So in what follows, I want to look at hope and despair in Nietzsche before turning to the work of Martin Heidegger, Emmanuel Levinas, and briefly, Jacques Derrida. So these thinkers exploit the convergence of hope and despair to rethink the nature of time. So they thus allow us to identify, what the final aim is of a critique of hope. What role do hope and hopelessness play in Nietzsche's thought? It is easy to assume that the Nietzschean death of God dismantles the conditions in which theological hope may serve as a referent for philosophical reflection, but the situation is much more complicated than this. It requires us to locate hope and despair on three levels in his work. The first concerns the death of God itself. This death obliterates the object, source, and final aim of Christian hope, yet it seems thereby to reproduce the logic of hoping against hope while actually depriving this logic of its transcendent referent. Let us recall that this death is first announced in the gay science, and that it there marks a transition from despair to hope in Nietzsche's own struggle with his physical maladies. On the first page of the 87 preface, Nietzsche describes the project in these terms, quote, "the gay science. This signifies the saturnalia of a mind that has patiently resisted a terrible long pressure, patiently, severely, coldly, without yielding, but also without hope, and is now all of a sudden attacked by hope for health, by the intoxication of recovery. This entire book is really nothing but an amusement after a long privation and powerlessness, the jubilation of returning strength, of a reawakened faith, of reopened seas, of goals permitted and believed in again," end quote. Now, the image of the reopened seas appears again in the opening section of Book 5, where Nietzsche asserts that, quote, "the greatest recent event that God is dead, that the belief in the Christian God has become a bit unbelievable, is already starting to cast its first shadow over Europe," end quote. In that context, Nietzsche predicts a long succession of demolition, that a long succession of demolition should follow closely on the heels of this announcement. Even still, the death of God means for him, quote, "that the sea, our sea, lies open again. Maybe there has never been such an open sea," end quote. What Nietzsche calls here the hope for health is one of the most immediate effects of the death of God. In its content and in its form, this hope stands at odds with its theological variant. On those few occasions when Nietzsche addresses theological hope, as he does in the Antichrist, he treats it as a holy lie. Here, again, I quote, "strong hope is a much greater stimulus to life than any piece of individual happiness that actually falls our way. Suffering people need to be sustained by a hope that cannot be refuted by any reality, that is not removed by any fulfillment, a hope for a beyond," end quote. The Greeks, Nietzsche adds, were rightly suspicious of hope. Precisely because of this capacity to string unhappy people along, Nietzsche claims, the Greeks considered hope to be the evil of evils, the truly insidious evil. By contrast, the primary object of hope in the gay science is that following the death of God, humanity will be able to love the world as it is. So what Nietzsche calls amor fati, or the love of faith, the love of necessity, is not entirely devoid of the qualities we attribute to radical hope, or which Lear attributes to radical hope. Yet it is difficult to avoid seeing it as a way of reconciling oneself with what is irrevocable. The love of faith is thus sadness lived as joy, despair transformed into a hope. So the second manner in which Nietzsche approaches hope and despair is at the level at which the love of fate passes over into what he calls tragic wisdom. Now, tragic wisdom is a prominent theme in the later Nietzsche from 1887 on. One of its best articulations appears in Ecce Homo, where Nietzsche takes stock of his entire trajectory from the perspective opened by the birth of tragedy. There he tells us that tragic wisdom, or Dionysian wisdom, Dionysian philosophy, consists primarily in, quote, "the affirmation of passing away and destruction, saying yes to opposition and to war, becoming along with a radical rejection of the very concept of being." Now, if the love of fate entails the affirmation of passing away, tragic wisdom goes a step further and calls for joy and destruction. The negative or no-saying element of Nietzsche's thought is lodged here at the level where Nietzsche is primarily concerned to show how tragic philosophy overcomes what he calls active and passive nihilism. In a notebook entry dated June 10, 1887, Nietzsche attests that, quote, "the belief in the absolute immorality of nature, in aim and meaninglessness, is the psychologically necessary affect once the belief in God and an essentially moral order becomes untenable. Nihilism appears at that point because one has come to mistrust any meaning in suffering, indeed in existence," end quote. So nihilism, the belief that existence is in vain, is thus the effect, not the cause, of the death of God. And it results in two different psychological affects. One, passive nihilism, refers to the paralysis that sets in after the moral interpretation of existence collapses, and it issues in the belief that one lacks the right to posit new values or a new meaning to experience. The other, active nihilism, refers to the will to self-destruction that takes hold among those, according to Nietzsche, who cannot fully accept the goallessness of existence. So active nihilism is a privileged form of despair for Nietzsche, what he calls hopeless despair. And it's extremely close to tragic wisdom. In fact, tragic wisdom emerges through the self-overcoming of active nihilism, that is, through the conversion of hopeless despair into the highest hope. It is impossible to ignore the fact that this conversion, which is nothing other than the revaluation of values in Nietzsche's work, is steeped in a lust for violence, one that justifies the means for the sake of the end. On the face of it, tragic philosophy for Nietzsche is really nothing other than the work of justifying destruction. In the June 10, 1887 passage, Nietzsche makes it clear that the tragic philosopher not only lets the will to destruction run its course in history, but helps it along by facilitating the destruction of culture after the death of God. The later Nietzsche's interest in discipline, in breeding, his love for warfare, his tendency to justify mass extermination for the sake of revaluation are all rooted in this impetus to live despair as a new kind of hope. Nietzsche's tragic philosophy thus demonstrates for us all too well the risks involved in assuming that the responsibility Lear associates with radical hope, namely the responsibility to become the spokesperson for the death of a way of life from within that way of life. So Nietzsche's tragic philosophy demonstrates the problems that are involved in assuming this kind of responsibility. So this latter paradigm, becoming the spokesperson for death, fits the tragic philosopher quite well, since Nietzsche sees in this philosopher humanity emerging from the chrysalis of morality. In terms of the critique of hope, tragic philosophy also illustrates that that radical hope inevitably risks justifying violence by virtue of the fact that it binds itself to an unforeseeable future. Hope chooses between being responsible for the present and being responsible for the future. Perhaps it is impossible to usher in the future without somehow turning away from the present, neglecting it, refusing to respond to it, even to the point of letting it die. Nietzsche certainly thinks so. What he calls his great hope, or his highest hope, marks the apex of irresponsibility with regard to the present. This hope refers to the coming of the figure of the Übermensch, the overman, a being whose capacity for joy in passing away is so great that this joy redeems existence in its entirety. Now, the love of fate and tragic wisdom both represent efforts to live despair as hope. So this is the model that I'm concerned with, despair as hope, as opposed to another model that I'll get to in a moment. It's at this level that we see Nietzsche embracing the spectacle of catastrophe. Right? There is, however, a third level at which hope and despair converge in Nietzsche, and though at this level the model that comes into view often serves the needs of what he calls Dionysian philosophy, I want to highlight the way in which, at this level, the convergence of hope and despair remains irreducible to this lust for violence. Now, the doctrine of eternal recurrence of the same famously stipulates that the universe is a tune that repeats itself endlessly, that everything that occurs has already occurred and will recur an infinite number of times. The doctrine atomizes time into a finite sequence of instants, each of which is effectively infinite since it recurs endlessly. Starting in late 1881, Nietzsche began describing the thought of eternal recurrence as the ultimate litmus test for affirming the world as it is. In the Gay Science, he argues that if one can embrace each and every instant as eternal, then one has essentially broken free from the moral interpretation of existence. The lesson imparted by Zarathustra, the figure of his central book, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, which he published over a series of years in the mid-1880s, is that all resentment, fundamentally, all resentment as such, originates out of the hatred of time. Quote, it was. Thus is called the will's gnashing of teeth and loneliest misery. Impotent against that which has been, it is an angry spectator of everything past. This, yes, this alone is revenge itself, the will's unwillingness toward time and time's it was, end quote. So the doctrine of eternal recurrence for Nietzsche overcomes the spirit of revenge by restoring what the passing of time seems to rob from us. Here I quote, everything seems far too valuable to be fleeting. I seek an eternity for everything. Ought one to pour the most precious salves and wine into the sea? My consolation is that everything that has been is eternal. The sea will cast it up again, end quote. Now, the doctrine of eternal recurrence aims to alter how we relate to the instant, and it does so by redefining eternity. It replaces the classical view of eternity as the standing now, and with it the notion of finite time as a mere shadow presence, with the notion that the instant is constituted recursively, by which I mean there is an infinite series of copies of the instant. So the recursive structure of the instant, according to this doctrine, determines, in my reading, presence as an abyss. It also makes it possible for the impulse of hope to rise out of this abyss in order to affirm the instant as an instant of resurrection. And here I quote, "All joy wants the eternity of things, wants honey, wants resin, wants drunken midnight, wants graves, wants tomb, tears, solace, wants gilded sunsets," end quote. Now, the doctrine of eternal recurrence can thus be read as a kind of radical hope for the present. Radical hope in this instance is the impulse that treats the present as its own incomprehensible resurrection, as well as its own tragic sacrifice. So on my reading, there is no intrinsic connection between this notion of the present as constituted recursively and the Nietzschean theme of joy in destruction. It is in fact entirely possible that the lust for destruction leads Nietzsche to cover over the recursive structure of the instant in ways that convert, in his hands at least, the doctrine of eternal recurrence into a dogmatic metaphysics of the will to power. Now, the doctrine of eternal recurrence thus potentially provides a check on the love of fate and tragic wisdom as they seek to turn to live or to turn despair into hope, or to live despair as hope. In their place, this doctrine thinks the presence of the instant as a mad hope for resurrection, as I've said. So it's on this level that I see Nietzsche as reproducing a vestige of the absurd logic of hope or theological hope. And this reproduction of theological hope, I think, has an intriguing effect on 20th century European philosophy. I think it actually invites philosophers in Nietzsche's wake to take up theological hope and to recast it in secular forms. So this is evident when we turn to Martin Heidegger. Perhaps no other 20th century thinker has done more to change how we think about time. Yet we have only recently come to terms with the extent to which Heidegger's conception of time remains indebted to his reading of Christian sources. The significance we assign to this indebtedness is bound to change once it is measured against the evidence contained in the so-called black notebooks. This is the term given to the notebooks Heidegger kept from 1931 until the early 1970s. In 2014, Vittorio Klostermann began publishing these notebooks, which had, until that time, had remained shrouded in secrecy, at least since Heidegger's death, as they were not housed in the Heidegger archive. Today, Klostermann has published the notebooks ranging from 1931 to 1948, with plans for more volumes to appear shortly. The notebooks currently at our disposal shed new light on Heidegger's participation in Nazi politics, but also the terms by which he sought to distance himself, publicly at least, from Nazism, starting in the mid-1930s. They also shed new light on his relationship to Nietzsche. So, what I want to do is sort of connect some of the things I see going on in the notebooks to Heidegger's early work on early Christian texts. So I want to sort of tell a story about how these two can be connected. So during the winter semester of 1920-21, Heidegger offered a lecture course at the University of Freiburg entitled Introduction to the Philosophy of to the Phenomenology of Religion. The second half of this course is entirely devoted to commenting upon Paul's first and second letters to the Thessalonians. And the results obtained in this course, while grappling with what he calls the eschatological problem in Paul, set the stage not only for the treatment of time in the text Being in Time, 1927, but also for Heidegger's effort to reconceptualize time in and through the so-called turn in his thinking from the 1930s on, from 1930 on. Now, the strange and unsettling resonances between Heidegger's initial confrontation with Paul in 21 and his fascination with eschatology in the notebooks from the mid-40s on provides ample material for our critique of hope, particularly as I would like to show that Heidegger begins by arguing that genuine hope should be enacted as despair, and he ends by arguing that despair should be enacted perversely as a kind of hope. The definition of the human being there, what Heidegger calls Dasein, the definition of Dasein as time, this definition that Heidegger spells out in the second half of Being and Time, has its origins in the basic insight that the question, what is time, is in fact badly posed. In a 1924 lecture at Marburg entitled The Concept of Time, Heidegger argues that the essential meaning of time has long been overshadowed by, in the history of philosophy, by the tendency to depict time as a line, as a parade of point-like instants flowing from the future through the present and into the past. So according to this model, time is nothing other than clock time. The future is not yet, the present is fleeting, the past is no longer. Heidegger concedes that clock time has its own legitimacy. It reflects how we handle time in average everyday life. But this average conception of time obscures the sense in which Dasein, human being there, can actually perform or enact its being as time. Time, in its existential significance for Heidegger, arises from anxiety before death. It is up to me, he claims, to decide how I respond to my own mortality. My demise, my death, stands before me as an ever-present yet indefinite possibility. I can either flee from this possibility or I can embrace it. If I embrace it, I therefore gain from this the possibility of truly becoming who I am. So authentic existence entails being responsible for my own history, for my own past. Only if I'm willing to take up my past through the anxiety of death can I exist authentically in the present moment. That's why Heidegger maintains in the existential conception of time that time flows from the future into the past and through the past into the present. The present is last. By this, Heidegger means that when I enact my time as being, then my existence has the character of a question. That is, the proper question is not what is time, but who is time? Or more specifically, am I myself time? And when I ask that question in the right way for Heidegger, then, in fact, my being has a structure of time. So recent scholarship has demonstrated that this conception of time as emerging from anxiety before death is significantly indebted to Heidegger's commentary on ancient sources, ancient Christian sources. I'll focus briefly on the 1921 reading of Paul's letter to the Thessalonians, since it is there that Heidegger takes up the eschatological problem as what he calls the center of Christianity. Now, historians of Christian thought commonly observe that the earliest Christian communities expected that the world would end during their lifetimes, and that the character of Christian religiosity fundamentally changed when Christians began to grapple with the fact that the parousia, or the second coming of the resurrected Christ, was delayed. This, however, is emphatically not what Heidegger has in mind when he speaks of the eschatological problem. Instead, he reserves the term for the form of Christian religiosity as it revolves around awaiting the parousia. Heidegger's turn to Paul is motivated by his sense in 1921 that modern philosophy lacks a genuine understanding of time and history. The commentary on Paul is designed to rectify this situation by showing how the phenomenon of authentic temporality emerges from, grows out of, as it were, the enactments of Christian religiosity. So the basic contours of this argument are not difficult to discern. Heidegger contends that for Paul, accepting the risen Christ means keeping awake, awaiting his imminent return. But everything hinges upon how one awaits this return. For Heidegger, the question of when Christ will return is, religiously speaking, meaningless. It's up to the Christian to do everything he or she can to hasten the return. And so long as the return has not yet occurred, the Christian cannot rest assured that he or she has done everything possible to bring it about. There's no security, he writes, for the Christian life. The constant insecurity is necessary. This insecurity reflects the heart of Paul's mission for Heidegger as an apostle or slave of Christ, as he's charged with announcing the good news. The eschatological problem refers above all to the fact that Christian hope in the present must be lived as its opposite, that is, as despair. Quote, if the parousia depends on how I live, then I am unable to maintain the faith and love that are demanded of me. At that point, I approach despair. Those who think this way worry themselves in a real sense under the sign of real concern, as to whether or not they can execute faith. Such is the form of Christian hope that Heidegger attributes to Paul in 1921. So Heidegger wrote, "Those who have understood Paul must be despairing because their anguish increases and each stands alone before God," end quote. Now, Heidegger's term for the necessity of enacting hope as despair is what he calls, it's awkward, but he calls it the enactmental knot. That's a mouthful. But this enactmental knot puts a check for him on all forms of self-righteousness. Now, the analogy between Pauline hope and despair and Heidegger's anxiety before death should be clear enough. Both of these structures have the effect of maximizing the sense of insecurity that accompanies their performance. The eschatological problem thus consists in the fact that the more genuinely one awaits the parousia, the more acutely one experiences oneself as failing to do so. For Heidegger, this means that the only proof of a truly genuine religious calling, the only one that Paul leaves open, is the ever-increasing anguish of living hope as despair. So we can see how the difference between clock time and existential time grows out of this reading of Paul. So Heidegger is interested in distinguishing what he calls objective history or history as a series of events from this underlying level of history, which is history as enactment. And the point is that religiosity is not detectable on the he claims on the first level because it's totally hidden away in this abyss on another level, right? But there's a way in which the two levels get conflated. There's another proof of religiosity in the reading of Paul, and it's one that, bizarrely enough, comes back in full force in the Black Notebooks. So the other proof of the calling, of a religious calling, according to Heidegger reading Paul now, is that the genuine believer is the one who is able to recognize the Antichrist. Quote, "Whether one is a true Christian is decided by the fact that one recognizes the Antichrist. With the Antichrist, each must decide. Even those who are unconcerned decide through their lack of concern," end quote. So that's from 1921. Now, so there's an analogy between the eschatological problem and anxiety before death, but is there any analogy to this issue of the Antichrist being a bridge between these two levels of history in Heidegger? Not until you come to the Black Notebooks, right? Not on my reading. The very notion that we're dealing with notebooks rather than treatises provides a certain cover for the intention of the Black Notebooks. Early on in the notebooks, at a time when Heidegger is already active in Nazi politics, he argues that the age of philosophy is now drawn to a close, and the real task facing the thinker is to replace philosophy with what Heidegger calls metapolitics. Now, the task of metapolitics is to anticipate the arising of a completely other kind of being in the world and to prepare its logic. That's the task of metapolitics. And Heidegger explicitly links metapolitics to what he calls the dawning of the new German Dasein, and thus to the destiny of National Socialism. So even when Heidegger resolves to break publicly with National Socialism in the mid-1930s, the task of the notebooks remains unaffected in its essential aspects by this break. Though he eventually sheds the title metapolitics, the task of the notebooks is from start to finish bound up with remaining loyal to the promise of this dawning of a new German Dasein in order to achieve in thought what National Socialism fails to achieve in act. Such is the context in which Heidegger takes up Nietzsche while turning back to the theme of eschatology. The latter term plays virtually no role in the notebooks until 1946, at which point Heidegger becomes obsessed with articulating what he calls the eschatology of being. But this eschatology is, in fact, the end result of a meditation on the desolation of Europe that is underway already in 1931. Already in 1931, Heidegger came to suspect that capitalism and communism threatened to destroy European culture, and that the only hope for resisting these forces of desolation would lie in defending Germany. There's a progression in the notebooks from resisting despair to embracing it. It's one that undoubtedly parallels the political fate of the Third Reich. Though Heidegger begins in 1929 by emphatically denying that thinking emerges from despair, he ends in 1947 by insisting no less emphatically that thinking and despair are the same. Quote, the despair of philosophy does not drive one out of thinking, but it and it alone leads into thinking. Despair, however, is not the sickness unto death, quoting Kierkegaard, but rather it is the reclaiming of being, where reclaiming says homecoming. Indeed, homecoming as a turning into the event of forgetting, which is at the same time humanity turning back to its mortality, end quote. So that's from 1947, from a portion of the Black Notebooks that's not yet translated. So Heidegger inverts the Pauline model here of hope as despair so that it becomes despair as hope. In so doing, he repeats the Nietzschean gesture of justifying catastrophe. The point of the notebooks is to show that we need to let the world in its current state, we need to let it die. Right? So it's here that the figure of the Antichrist emerges in the notebooks. In the 14th notebook, dating roughly from 1940-41, Heidegger describes the fate of Germans as they face the desolation of the world at the hands of Americanism as such. Quote, everyone is talking about the Antichrist. Were he to come, he would be a harmless child compared to what is happening now, something which has already found its henchmen, end quote. The implication is not only that the villain faced by the Germans is far stronger than the Antichrist, but also that it's virtually impossible to recognize. But this doesn't prevent Heidegger from identifying the Antichrist with one group in particular. Quote, the Antichrist must come, like everything anti, out of the same essential ground from whence comes what is against. So it is with the Christ. The anti comes out of Judaism. In the time space of the Christian West, that is to say metaphysics, Jewishness is the principle of destruction, end quote. That passage dates from 1942, the year in which the Nazi leadership met at the Wannsee Conference to discuss the final solution. Heidegger does not shy away from arguing that the principle of destruction must itself be eradicated, only he insists that Nazism itself, insofar as it has betrayed its promise, has now become something quote-unquote Jewish and so must be destroyed. Quote, only when what is essentially Jewish in a metaphysical sense first fights against the Jews has the high point of self-annihilation been reached. Granted, the Jew has everywhere completely usurped sovereignty, so that those who fight against the Jews and above all others remain trapped, subordinated to them, end quote. Now, in what sense can we read this metaphysical anti-Semitism, which infects Heidegger's thinking, as a response to Nietzsche? By 1942, Heidegger had concluded that Nietzsche's effort to overcome metaphysics had failed. Having merely inverted the priority of being over becoming, Nietzsche remained trapped within metaphysics. This anti-Semitism in the notebooks forges an essential connection between the figure of the Jew and metaphysics. In so doing, it sets the terms in which Heidegger appropriates the Nietzschean doctrines of revaluation and of the eternal recurrence. Like Nietzsche before him, Heidegger concludes that the present world must be allowed to not annihilate itself in order to usher in a new age. And he argues that thinking paves the way for the coming of this new age to the degree that it poses the question of being to itself. Right? Strangely enough, Heidegger on several occasions likens this dynamic to the eternal recurrence. So it's as if the human being needs to become the eternal recurrence. Now, for the critique of hope, I want to suggest that neither the case of Nietzsche, this should be obvious, neither the case of Nietzsche nor that of Heidegger speaks very highly in favor of the model I'm calling despair as hope. In their hands, at least, the model seems to be particularly vulnerable to the risk of justifying what we might call radical evil. What are we then to make of Unamuno's claim that despair alone engenders heroic hope? And what about this other model, namely hope as despair? So having glimpsed hope as despair in the Nietzschean doctrine of eternal recurrence, we then saw it emerge briefly in the commentary on Paul, right? But Heidegger gravitates away from it in the Black Notebooks. Now this rejection of hope as despair, I believe, is antithetical to the strategy that Emmanuel Levinas uses to expose what he sees as the fatal flaws of Heideggerian time, of Heidegger's concept of time. In a remarkable sequence toward the end of Existence and Existence, much of which Levinas composed in a prisoner of war camp, he lays a foundation for redefining time in terms of hope. And here I have a particularly striking quote. What produces the thrust of hope is the gravity of the instant in which it occurs. The irreparable is its natural atmosphere. There is hope only when hope is no longer permissible. What is irreparable in the instant of hope is that the instant is present. The future can bring consolation or compensation to a subject who suffers in the present, but the very suffering of the present remains like a cry whose echo will resound forever in the eternity of space. Now, Levinas is careful to distinguish the intentional character or the thrust of hope, he's distinguishing this, from the instant that is intended by it. What he calls the irreparable is not, strictly speaking, the instant as the intentional correlate of hope, but it's rather the presence of this instant, the way in which that instant is there. So the irreparable present is thus constituted as such by hope, right? Without being reducible to that intention, right? The intention of hope. So this suggests not only that time cannot be constituted dialectically, but also that hope and despair, no matter how they are constituted, are incapable of redeeming the present. Quote, the impossibility of constituting time dialectically is the impossibility of saving oneself by oneself, of saving oneself alone. What is tragic in the human is the definitiveness of the present, and in positing the function of the eye as something inseparable from the tragic structure, we recognize that we are not going to find in the subject the means for its own salvation, end quote. So within this insight, it seems to me Levinas takes leave of Nietzsche and Heidegger, but not without enlisting their concepts against them. What Levinas shares with Nietzsche is first the idea that the presence of the present is abysmal. Second, it's the sense that hope is directed primarily toward the present, not toward the future. And here I quote from Levinas, to understand the mystery of the work of time, we should start with the hope for the present taken as a primary fact. Hope hopes for the present itself. Its martyrdom doesn't slip into the past, leaving us with the right to wages. At the very moment when all is lost, everything is possible, end quote. None of this, however, leads Nietzsche to embrace the despairing notion that the subject is charged with redeeming itself. As for Heidegger, Levinas follows his lead in distinguishing between the present and the present, yet Levinas enlists the distinction to belie the myth that time is uniform. Heidegger contends that the human being unifies itself in anxiety toward death. Levinas, however, detects in this myth of uniformity the misguided attempt at saving oneself. This is why he contends in Existence and Existence that hope for the present opens up a transcendence. It is not enough, he writes, that tears be wiped away or death avenged. No tear is to be lost. No death is to be without a resurrection. Hope is not satisfied with a time composed of separate instants given to an ego that traverses them, so as to gather in the following instant, as impersonal as the first, the wages of its pain. The true object of hope is the Messiah. According to this model, time is produced in the demand that the instant of despair be redeemed, but the act that demands this redemption cannot achieve it. When Levinas argues that time is lived as the resurrection of the irreplaceable instant, he does not envision resurrection as a final reparation. To do this would be to admit that time is constituted dialectically. It's not that time resurrects the irreparable instant itself, but rather that the thrust of hope is the resurrection, albeit one that always arrives too late. Levinas does not elaborate upon hope for the present after Existence and Existence, but he does consistently defend the model I'm calling hope as despair. That such a model, for example, aptly describes the ethical relation in his work is clear from the essay entitled The Trace of the Other, in which Levinas, while describing the ethical relation as a one-way movement, uncovers, a despairing eschatology. Here I quote, the future for which just work is undertaken must be posited from the start as indifferent to my death. Patience does not consist in the agent belying his generosity by giving himself the time of personal immortality. To renounce being the contemporary of a triumph of one's work is to have this triumph in a time without me. It's to aim at this world without me, to aim at a time beyond the horizon of time. It works an eschatology without hope for oneself as an eschatology of liberation from my own time, end quote. Now, there's no discrepancy here between the hope for the present and the despairing eschatology, since in both cases, it is a question of aiming for a time beyond time, one that announces, as Levinas will put it, the alterity of the other. In Levinas's despairing eschatology, the slightest complacency promises to annul the ethical relation. Now, the stringency of this demand is what makes Levinasian ethics resemble the eschatological problem in Heidegger, or as he uncovers it in Paul, though Levinas would never treat anguish as proof of one's own religious calling. In repudiating the unity of time, Levinas reaffirms that despair alone engenders hope, or radical hope, heroic hope. And it's in rigorously distinguishing between the present and the present, presence and the present, he suggests that despair as hope is a form of complacency. Does that mean we should give up on it altogether? Well, before we do so, I want to very briefly, by way of conclusion, consider the example of Jacques Derrida. The irresolvable conflict between the two eschatologies we are describing here, despair as hope and hope as despair, is a consistent theme in Derrida's writings dating back to his 1964 essay entitled Violence and Metaphysics. In the final pages of this essay, Derrida frames the Levinasian critique of the unity of time in terms of a clash between a philosophical eschatology in Heidegger, which we're calling the eschatology of being, and the extraordinary phenomenon of prophetic eschatology that Levinas sees as interrupting the violent and totalizing discourse of philosophy. As Levinas writes in Totality and Infinity, eschatology, quote, institutes a relation with being beyond the totality, beyond history. It's a relationship with a surplus, always exterior to totality, end quote. Now, though Derrida does not disagree, his concern in Violence and Metaphysics is, first, that in situating subjectivity on the side of prophetic eschatology, Levinas risks a kind of triumphalism of humility. And second, that this triumphalism is already minimally present in Levinas's claim to glimpse the beyond as it breaks into history. So for this reason, Derrida is not entirely willing to jettison Heideggerian eschatology, or what I'm calling despair as hope. Derrida's insistence on playing these two eschatologies against each other largely determines his approach to religion in general. The notion that the messianic is a general structure of human experience runs throughout Derrida's later work. In the mid-1980s, Derrida would argue that human experience is constituted by an invincible desire for justice in the present, and that this desire exposes one to an unanticipatable future. What he calls messianicity without messianism signifies an opening to the future as the advent of justice. As a structural feature of human experience, this opening does not necessarily belong to any determinate religious tradition. It's what Derrida calls a quasi-transcendental. On the one hand, we must speak of it in terms borrowed from the Abrahamic religions, which suggests that this very structure is perhaps nothing more than an after effect of these religions. But on the other hand, it's possible that the Abrahamic religions themselves are concrete instances of this more fundamental, more abstract messianicity. So Derrida thus sees the work of deconstruction as affirming abstract messianicity beyond or outside of the confines of particular messianisms. He links the messianic to what he calls democracy to come. There's a defense, a deep defense of liberal democracy in his work. So in this manner, he grants Levinas's claim that eschatology institutes a relation with the beyond, but at the same time, he does not want to give up the recursive structure of time that engenders despair as hope in Nietzsche and Heidegger. So by asserting the claims of abstract messianicity, Derrida wants to elaborate what he calls a culture of singularities, democracy, beyond the confines of particularisms. He sees it as emerging out of particularism. So in effect, he wants to show that the ideals of democracy represent the legacy in modernity of the Abrahamic traditions. Now, the link between democracy and messianicity remains controversial for many readers of Derrida, who fail to grant that there is any necessary connection between the two. For other commentators, the notion that messianicity is a universal structure of experience leaves Derrida, if not deconstruction itself, open to the charge of political quietism. Now, by contrast, I'd like to suggest, by way of concluding, that Derridean messianicity and its link to democracy should be judged not only against the very real dangers exposed in despair as hope, in the despair as hope model in Nietzsche and Heidegger, but also against the resurgence of a parallel danger that Derrida locates on the side of hope as despair in Levinas. What I find exemplary in Derrida for the critique of hope is his insight that the demand for justice in the present passes through a moment of absolute irresponsibility or of madness. The implication is that hope, too, when it radicalizes itself, harbors the same moment of absolute irresponsibility within it. For Derrida, in other words, the same gesture that constitutes radical hope as a commitment to justice leaves it exposed and permanently exposed to the justification of the worst possible forms of violence. In the case of messianicity, Derrida refers to this double bind as duplicity. He speaks of the duplicity of religion, by which he suggests that the highest good and the worst evil have a common origin. In the end, the insight, very modestly, I would like to suggest, should clarify for us the final aims of a critique of hope. If radical hope contains an element of madness within it, if hope draws from madness the power to turn against itself, if turning against itself is, in fact, madness, then a critique of hope that is geared solely or primarily toward establishing the conditions under which this hope is virtuous is destined to fail. In treating hope as a habit or a state of character, the critique of hope would be destined to overlook its potential dangers. It is destined to overlook the way in which a messianic politics takes root in the subject through the desire for salvation. The critique of hope, acting as a safeguard against what Heidegger would call metapolitics, must instead take aim at the ways in which messianic hope gives rise to a messianic politics. We must pull them apart, right? Detach the resurgence of messianic politics from messianic hope. For as Maurice Blanchot reminds us, messianic hope is inevitable when history appears as politically arbitrary, a process deprived of meaning and direction. But if political thinking becomes messianic in its turn, then this confusion will attest, quote, and here I quote Blanchot, to a time so frightful, so dangerous, that any recourse will be justified. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Ryan Coyne, Assistant Professor of the Philosophy of Religions and Theology at University of Chicago Divinity School. Professor Coyne's lecture was titled An Elegant Hope, Despair as a Virtue After Nietzsche, and was presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion. Tonight's moderator was Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jeff Turton. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydonis. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.